This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Rock, a subspecies of a rock and roll animal that is full of flash, electric guitars, androgyny, decadence, and no small amount of hair. There was a glam explosion in the 1970s, and you can say there are still some flashes of glam and glitter around today. But what drove glam rock? What did it mean? And does its music hold up today? We're talking with rock journalist Simon Reynolds about his latest book, Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy, from the 70s to the 21st century. And this is a pre-recorded show. We can't take any callers today, but we can play a lot of music, so sit back and enjoy. And Simon, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Glam rock. How do you see glam rock? What is the glam rock thing?
Well, glam rock was like a movement that lasted about 3 or 4 years in the early 70s, but it had a lot of legacy, a lot of kind of aftershocks and reverberations through subsequent decades. So the core of it, I guess, is, you know, what coheres the various groups is visual primarily. It's about a certain kind of visual excess and a kind of glamour that's almost like a cartoon of glamour. Like it doesn't have it's not glamour in the conventional sense of movie stars or say a pop figure of that era like Diana Ross. It's much more like a mad mishmash of elements that reference Hollywood glamour and reference, you know, mainstream razzle dazzle, but it's kind of absurdist and taken really too far. So, you know, the giant platform boots, the satin jackets, the glitter on the cheeks, everything is overstated and over the top. You know, the key stars of glam would be Mark Bolan of T-Rex, David Bowie, Roxy Music. In the States, it would be New York Dolls, and Lou Reed was part of it for a while. And then there's sort of glam fellow travelers, Elton John, Queen, Kiss, you could say, as a sort of an offshoot of glam. Alice Cooper brought this kind of theatricality to pop with his sort of outrageous shock rock theatrics on stage, like Fake Executions and things. So there's a whole gamut of expression within it, but the core of it is this sort of absurdist cartoon version of glamour.
What would you say would be like the iconic glam rock song, the touchstone?
One of the songs that really kicked it all off, and it was a hit in the States as well as in Britain, would be Bang a Gong by T-Rex. Get It On is the original title, and they, for various reasons, they retitled it Bang a Gong. That was T-Rex's only real hit in the States. In Britain, he was like a huge superstar and had like half a dozen number one singles and hordes of girls screaming at him, some boys screaming at him as well. Another classic, you know, classic glam rock song would be Suffragette City by David Bowie, or maybe even better would be Rebel Rebel, which is just like, it has the glam chorus line, you know, not sure if you're a boy or a girl, which gets right to the heart of glam, the cross-dressing, the androgyny, the, you know, the gender bending. And so that, you know, that Rebel Rebel, I think, by David Bowie would be like an archetypal glam song.
We're talking about the book Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy from the 70s to the 21st century. And we're speaking with the author of the book, Simon Reynolds. Simon, when you were talking about the excess of glam rock, but also it seemed there's a level of self-awareness about it. And it was kind of very meta in the sense that they knew that this was a show and this was a put on and not an actual demonstration of a lifestyle. Is that accurate?
I think there was an element of fantasy and being a fantasy self on stage and on record. You know, the archetypal expression of that meta-ness that you mentioned would be Ziggy Stardust, where it's, you know, the record is about an imaginary rock star and it's a character that Bowie's playing. And then he went on to invent further characters like the Thin White Duke. But with all the glam stars, there's a kind of a lot of the songs are kind of commentaries on stardom and fame. Mott the Hoople, who are part of this, you know, because they were kind of adopted by Bowie and he wrote all the young dudes for them, made them big stars. They had a lot of songs that were about being in a band. They had a song called The Ballad of Mott the Hoople. A song called Marionette, which is all about feeling like you're a puppet and someone, you know, you're on stage and it's become a routine and someone's pulling your strings, you know, and getting lost in the rock and roll fantasy. And perhaps the ultimate meta song of that whole era in terms of glam would be Fame by David Bowie, which was his biggest hit in the States, number one. And that's just like an amazing, really kind of quite chilling and harrowing glimpse into the paranoid bubble of mega fame. And you know the lyrics are about, you know, all these egos jostling, famous people, you know, pulling rank on each other, and who can you trust, and it's quite an amazing song, and I think prefigures a lot of the obsession with fame in our culture. You know, rappers who become famous by rapping about being famous, like Drake and Kanye West, Lady Gaga with her album The Fame Monster. That to me is, you know, where I connect glam themes and glam obsessions with more recent pop.
Well, let's listen to David Bowie's Fame. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be back after this. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about the book Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy from the 70s to the 21st century with a rock and roll journalist, Simon Reynolds. And so, Simon, when you write about the music, you're not just writing about the music in this book, you're writing about the era in which it was formed. And you say that there's a connection between conservative politics and the eruption of glam.
Yeah, I think if you look at glam historically and other phases of pop music, when sort of glam obsessions with image and fame and stardom rise to dominate pop music, you know, in the early 70s, it was the era of Nixon and of similar kind of conservative governments in the UK, and then in the 80s when you have all the sort of MTV video pop bands, the British New Romantics, and then later hair metal. That's, you know, the Reagan Bush era and the Thatcher era, and more recently in the 21st century, I associate a lot of the sort of obsession with fame and making it and this very competitive pop ethos of, you know, got to be a star at all costs. I associate that with a sort of rightward turn in politics in the 21st century. It's a view of the world in which there are these sort of extraordinary individuals who triumph and make it and win, and then the rest of us who are kind of marveling at them and sort of wishing we were like them. Whereas other eras of music, like punk rock, 60s, the countercultural 60s, certainly, the punk rock era, and the grunge era, it's much, the ethos is much more like, you know, we don't want stars. Everyone, it's about community. It's about the collective. It's you know, it's not about glamour. You know, grunge was against glamour. Grunge was a revolt against hair metal, which, you know, fans of hair metal call it glam metal. You know, it's very linked to the glam spirit.
Or the Ramones, who were...
Ramones. It's dressed down. I mean, the relationship between glam and punk is interesting because many of the punks were glam and glitter fans. You know, the Ramones were into glitter music. You know, you scratch the skin of a punk in the UK and you'll find a Bowie or a Roxy fan underneath. Susie and the Banshees, the two key members of that band, met at a Roxy Music concert in 1974. So musically, there are a lot of links between the... You know, the glam sound tends to be this tough, aggressive, focused, very sort of minimal hard rock sound. And that's, you know, that's kind of very much what punk is, you know. So there are musical links. But I think the ethos of punk was much more, you know, leveling, democratic, egalitarian, and sort of, you know, talking about real things, talking about the kind of real life problems, social issues, things that affected kids on the street, like unemployment and that kind of stuff. It was a return to reality, and glam was very much like, no, let's leave reality behind, let's just escape into this fantasy world.
Now Ziggy played guitar, jamming good in Web and Gilly, and the Spiders from Mars. We played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were sick as bad.
Some people put Iggy Pop in both of those categories. And how do they do that?
Well, that's one of the interesting things, the relationship between glam and punk, is you have a figure like Iggy, who was associated with David Bowie, and you know, David Bowie produced Raw Power. For a very brief moment, Iggy is wearing kind of silver hair and a little bit of eye makeup and has a little bit of a glam image. You have the New York Dolls as well. But are the New York Dolls a glam band, or are they a proto-punk band? It's very hard to say. There's a lot of links between glam and punk. I think with Iggy, his thing was always too kind of wild and real and abandoned to really fit the glam sort of straitjacket in a way, which glam is very much about posing and it's quite controlled, you know. Someone like Bowie is quite a, you know, people used to accuse him of being cold and calculated, and he would say, I am cold and calculated. I plan what I do very carefully. With Iggy, certainly on stage, it's much more like this person is just going crazy and wild. He had his own kind of theater, but it was a different, you know, Bowie described Iggy as having this street theater, this natural theater, Detroit theater. But it wasn't anything like the theater that Bowie did, which involved, you know, or Alice Cooper did, which involved costumes and props and stage sets and, you know, a lot of the paraphernalia we associate with musical theater and Broadway and Hollywood. Iggy was much more like this improvised form of stage theatrics that involved really kind of testing his body to the limit, injuring himself, doing these terrifying backbends and flips. You know, you just gasp when you see a photograph of them.
And what would be a good Iggy Pop song to play here?
Gimme Danger would be a good one, off Raw Power.
Okay, let's hear it.
Gimme Danger, little stranger, and I'll be you a me. Gimme Danger, little stranger, and I'll be you this me. Nothing in my dream, just some ugly memory. Kiss me like the ocean breeze. Hey! Now if you will be my lover, yeah.
is Iggy Pop, Gimme Danger, and we're talking about glam rock. And believe it or not, Iggy Pop fits into the category of glam rock and punk rock at the same time. That's according to rock journalist Simon Reynolds. His newest book is Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy from the 70s to the 21st Century. I want to go back to some of the stuff you said earlier about, you know, how the political or economic environment will somehow excrete glam rock or something of its fashion when it's necessary. And I'm thinking of other times prior to even the invention of rock and roll. And I'm wondering if sometimes if glam rock wasn't Busley Berkeley set to a 3-chord changeup and a 4-4 beat.
Well, that's a very good point because, and in fact, Alice Cooper said, I want to be the Busby Berkeley of rock. And, you know, you had people actually, like the performer Gary Glitter, perform with a staircase. You know, they got it from the British film studio, Elstree, I think. They hired one of these sort of staircases like you get in an old musical, and he made his stage entrance coming down the steps. Elton John did something very similar at the Hollywood Bowl. Alice Cooper was one of the people who said, actually, you know, he kind of broke with the 60s ethos. The 60s ethos was like, rock is over here, showbiz and musicals and things like that is over there, and we don't have anything to do with it. What we do is real and from the gut. And we're talking about, you know, things directly from our experience. And Alice Cooper was one of the first people to say, well, actually, rock music is just another branch of showbiz, and I'm going to be the ultimate showman. And, you know, he had, like, choreographed routines. He had costumes. He had props. He had stage sets. You know, he took on the whole paraphernalia, really, of showbiz and razzle dazzle, but with a rock and roll twist, because it was dark. You know, you were seeing kind of horrible things happening on stage. You know, fake executions, him chopping up babies. So it was a kind of horror movie version, you know, of Hollywood. It was, you know, Bela Lugosi and Vincent Price, I think. I think he wanted to be the Vincent Price of rock. And actually, in one of his records, one of his spectaculars, Welcome to My Nightmare, I think he actually got Vincent Price to have a guest cameo role in this TV production he did in 1975. So that was all, you know, Busby Berkeley would have been a reference point for Alice Cooper. That would have been something he aspired to. 'Cause you belong.
Welcome to my breakdown.
Alice Cooper always used to say, like, what rock was looking for is a villain. And so he kind of took on this role as a sort of almost a vaudevillian bad guy, you know. But it was like a persona. He was able to separate them. And then in real life, he was this sort of laid-back dude, very pleasant. A smart guy, a fan of Salvador Dali, and quite sort of moral, relatively speaking, did not go in for the rock and roll excesses. A lot of people in America, particularly parents, thought he was for real, a genuinely creepy, scary dude, because his aura was, you know, he had the scary makeup with the slashes under his eyes, he had snakes, he had this sort of slimy, abject aura around him, and he was a genuine kind of bogeyman figure. But if you read the rock papers and you read the interviews with him, it became aware that he was this sort of reflective, quite laid-back, quiet dude who sort of became this character on stage and did these depraved acts, but it wasn't actually, it was meant to be a commentary on the public's appetite for violence and horrible things, not so much an incitement to evil.
So let's hear some Alice Cooper. This is Under My Wheels.
Sure.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. We're talking about Shock and Awe. That's the name of the book, Glam Rock and Its Legacy from the 70s to the 21st Century. We've got rock journalist Simon Reynolds with us. We're going to continue our conversation talking about this astonishing age, this part of rock and roll history, when we come back from NPR Newscast. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Today we're joined by Simon Reynolds, author of Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy from the 70s to the 21st Century. We cannot take calls today, unfortunately, because we're recording this show. And let me ask you, Simon, how was glam rock received? There was an audience, but was it a mass audience?
Glam had a huge following in the UK, and then it had a sort of cult following in America, particularly concentrated in New York and L.A., and also it had, you know, fans in Detroit and Cleveland, but in the great sort of middle of America, glam did not really take off until Kiss kind of broke some of those ideas on a mass level. It was very much like a reaction against the late 60s when music got very serious and it wasn't supposed to be commercial or about image or spectacle. Bands were like very much about musicianship and, you know, substantial grown-up stuff was being written about in songs. Basically, the first generation of rock musicians were kind of growing up and talking about adult things, and they wanted to be taken seriously as musicians. And they all grew beards, you know. And there wasn't really people think about albums. They weren't like making singles so much. And glam kind of jumped into this gap in the market where teenagers wanted singles, great sort of catchy singles with a beat that you could dance to. And they wanted idols, you know, people to scream at and sort of idolize and worship and even dress up like, which was a kind of new thing that glam introduced, was people like dressing like Bowie or dressing like T-Rex. So that's sort of, you know, for the younger brothers and sisters and the sort of early teens, especially, glam was this fantastic thing that was their music. It was the first music of the 70s that really was for them. You know, there's a song the Sweet did called Teenage Rampage, which sort of was their kind of gift to the fans, saying, you know, this is your time, this is your music. You know, some of them could see, you know, could see that Bowie was an interesting artist, could see that Roxy Music were doing clever things, but they tended to sort of think that it was a decline from the seriousness of the late 60s, of you know, the era of groups like The Band, the Allman Brothers stretching music out of the way, the kind of serious commentary and poetic depth of Dylan and what the Beatles had done. So there was a kind of a lot of people were kind of sniffy about groups like The Sweet and Slade and T-Rex and thought it was, you know, just bubblegum music, really.
The Sweet is an interesting band. Talk a little bit more about them. Give me a good song for them. We'll play that first.
Ballroom Blitz, I think, would be
Oh, yeah.
One to play.
Ballroom Blitz.
Yeah. Mick? Okay. All right, fellas. Let's go! so hard living with the things you do to me. Oh, my things are getting so strange. I like to tell you everything I see.
One.
Oh, yeah, it was like lightning. Everybody was frightening. And the music was soothing. And they all started grooving.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And the man at the back said, everyone attack, and they turned into a ballroom blitz. And the girl in the corner said, boy, I want the money, and it'll turn into a ballroom blitz. Ballroom blitz. Ballroom blitz. Ballroom blitz.
So sweet. You know the music, but you forgot about the band, you know, when it comes to Sweet. What's their story?
The Sweet actually did start out as a bubblegum band. They were very much sort of modelled on the success of the Archers with Sugar Sugar. And, you know, they were a band of really capable musicians who were not for a long while allowed to actually record on their own records. The A-sides, the single side for radio play was recorded by session musicians. The songs were written by this team of songwriters. They were like puppets at first, but they really resented it, and they chafed against this control. They wanted to be like Deep Purple. They wanted to be a credible hard rock band, and if you listen to the B-sides, you hear these quite fierce songs. And gradually, their music got tougher and tougher, and it became a perfect sort of, for me, blend of the pop process, where it's very controlled by the producer, and you have these professional songwriters, and then all the virtues of rock. You know, it's aggressive, it's hard, it's well played, the drums sound amazing. And so there's this perfect sort of balance. But of course it was a very tense situation because the band didn't like being perceived as puppets. Eventually they broke free and you know, wrote their own A-sides and produced themselves and did the song Fox on the Run, which was a huge hit.
Well, let's listen to Fox on the Run. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we're talking about the era of music in which glam was it. Glam rock and its legacy from the 70s to the 21st century with the author Simon Reynolds. It seemed like there was a glam ghetto, you know, that a lot of performers today will take on the trappings. They will have learned showmanship, all sorts of things from the glam performers, but they don't want to have anything to do with the title of glam or glitter. Why do you think that is?
I think because it's had an association with something that was ephemeral and passed quite quickly. Some various musicians that I wanted to interview were like, oh, I don't want to be associated with glam. There's a lot more to my career than that. You know, Bowie quickly said, well, my glam phase was just a couple of years.
He said that glam only lasted 18 months and there were only three glam bands.
Yeah, which I think is wishful thinking and rewriting of history. There was a lot of people in this moment and sort of fellow travelers as well who went on to have, you know, much longer careers like Queen. Queen, when they started out, said, oh, we're worried that they had missed the glam moment and that, you know, that people thought they were just copying what Bowie and the Sweet had done, and they took it in a whole direction of sort of total excess, and you know, I describe it as being like Baroque music. You know, obviously there's an opera influence in there, but just the layers of and the ornamentation of the production, and the, you know, on Bohemian Rhapsody there's something like 180 vocal overdubs, It's this incredibly super produced sound they have, but then, you know, live they could deliver in this kind of kick-ass Led Zepp way as well. It had a lot more, there were a lot more people involved or sort of connected with glam than people would instantly think, and I think that the afterlife of it is really strong. If you look at the influence it had on a lot of punks who had been glam fans, if you look at the 80s MTV Brit Invasion groups with their very strong sense of image and you know, the video aesthetic that they pioneered, that comes from glam. There's hair metal, very indebted to glam. If you look at Guns N' Roses' Welcome to the Video, Welcome to the Jungle video, Axl Rose has got quite a bit of makeup on in that video. So it touches a lot of people that you wouldn't think. And then,
and does it all lead back to Mark Bolan?
I think so. I mean, but I think you could say that there's glam running through the whole history of rock. In I see the Rolling Stones as kind of being like godfathers of glam. Little Richard was a very flamboyant performer, and one of his costumes later in his career, I think, was like a suit that was made entirely out of tiny mirrors, which, you know, is about as glam as it gets. So I think, you know, there were showmen in rock like Screaming Jay Hawkins, The Crazy World of Arthur Brown was very theatrical. There are predecessors to glam, and then there are sort of descendants of glam that, to me, make it kind of a lineage running through rock. This side of rock music that sort of blends into showbiz and sort of takes aspects of showbiz.
Let's play a piece of music here. How about David Essex, Good Old Rock and Roll?
Yeah, great. Right.
Like a schoolboy shaking and quaking, you fill me up for your rules. Like a king's jester, you made me faster, teaching me to be your fool. Well, you told me I got to do something, so I said to fall.
We're talking about glam rock and roll and how it influences music today. You may think that glam is trifling and not worthy of your examination, but if you listen to rock, you have glam to thank for certain elements of it. And the author of the book is Simon Reynolds, and the book is Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy. There are some influential female rock and rollers who took up glam or inspired by it, like Grace Jones, Annie Lennox.
Yeah, I think that's one of the odd things about glam is that, it, you know, the original wave of glam in the early 70s, it's mostly entirely men, with one exception, Susie Quattro, and then a little bit later, the Runaways with Joan Jett. But it's you know, it's men dressing up like women or looking effeminate and looking prettified. And there it wasn't very easy for women to find an equivalent move that had the same effect. Susie Quattro kind of toughened up her image and was like a kind of lead of the gang kind of thing. Of her all-male band, she was like the tough chick telling them what to do. It took a bit later before you got a sort of glam-influenced women coming up with a sort of unique version of the glam effect, which was these sort of very severe, angular-looking styled women like Susie Sue, the Banshees, Grace Jones, Annie Lennox, in a different sort of way, Kate Bush. These, I think of them as like the real coming of female glam. And then the baton is picked up in the 21st century with Lady Gaga, with Kesha, with Janelle Monáe, even Nicki Minaj, and to some extent, with her, you know, really eye-popping image and her multiple personas. The female glam wave comes later.
Okay, well, let's listen to Kesha, We Are Who We Are. And this is Texas Public Radio, The Source. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about glam rock and its legacy with author Simon Reynolds. There is still glam. It's still part of the pulse today.
Yeah, I think you can see its DNA all over the place, in all kinds of corners of music. And there's, you know, there's people who don't necessarily sound like the classic era glam, but they have a lot of the preoccupations and the imagery, like Lady Gaga or like Kesha, who uses a lot of glitter in her act and her image. And then you have groups who actually, you know, are trying to revive the sound of the sort of stomping sound of groups like Slade and The Sweet, like this great Italian band called Guida. And then you have sort of all kinds of gender-bending, androgynous performers today like Anoni. I suppose it doesn't have quite the same impact as it did in the 70s. I think that's one of the things that sort of
We're mature now.
Yeah, I think we've become a lot more, you know, well, some of us anyway, not everyone in this society or culture, but yeah, things have moved on. You know, it's several decades since the 70s, and it's actually sometimes quite hard to remember how repressed things were.
Well, that was the thing about glam that interests me, is the being able to shuck off inhibitions. And there was a lot of freedom on the stage that you could apply to your music.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ethos was just to be extreme and outlandish, and really it was a kind of anything goes spirit and a kind of competition to look more absurd, really, which was taken to the absolute limit by the British performer Gary Glitter, now a very controversial figure because of, you know,
his pedophile stuff.
Sex crimes, yes, and he's in prison. But at the time, he, you know, he's most known in this country for his perennial Jock Jam Rock and Roll Part 2, which is chanted at many an arena, perhaps not so much these days.
Rock and Roll Part 2 from Gary Glitter, the icon of campy theatrics of glam rock. And we're talking about glam rock with this book, Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy. The author is Simon Reynolds. Do you think, because you've written about the regurgitation aspects of rock and roll quite a bit, they're always looking backward and bringing stuff up forward and calling it brand new, taking the same product and putting a new label on it. Will ever see another heyday of glam rock again?
I don't know. I don't know if there could be a movement that had the same effect as glam, and I don't know if there could really be a revival as such, partly because a lot of glam was quite revivalist in itself. It had these borrowings and echoes of the 50s, I think the sort of spirit of it will recur at various intervals. It actually feels now like it's about time we had a sort of anti-glam phase. Yeah, there's not a lot at the moment that's super exciting apart from certain rap artists like Future. I don't think there's a lot to galvanize young people, and that's perhaps why music has sort of dropped away as like one thing you like, sort of as a background to other things you do. You know, it's almost like music has lost its sort of forefront role in people's lives and become just something that you like and enjoy, but it doesn't form your identity, which I think as well is one of the interesting things about glam, is it was identity formation music, and young people growing up at that time, it had a real profound effect on them. And that's why when Bowie died, you know, you had this outpouring of grief from people of a certain age where it's like they're mourning themselves, you know what I mean? Like, it's like this, a lot of people would say things like, David Bowie gave us permission to be freaks. David Bowie, you know, without David Bowie, I wouldn't have done this, you know. So I don't know if there's a pop star today who has that effect on people, where it shows them possibilities and has that sort of transforming effect on your idea of yourself and what you could be in life.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll, and so he said. Then the loud sound, it seemed to fade. Came back like a slow voice on a wave of fate. That weren't no DJ, that was hazy. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, 'cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children use it. Let the children use it. Let all the children do it.
Shock and Awe is the name of the book, Glam Rock and Its Legacy from the 70s to the 21st Century. The author is Simon Reynolds, and Simon, it was great talking with you.
Great to talk to you, too.